Okay. Right. Do intro, I guess. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of History Hermanos. This is Tom and my opposite number is Simon, and today we're going to be reviewing Gregory Litkei. We were struggling with the pronunciation. Anyway, Litkei's book called Enduring Whirlwinds: The German Army and the Russo-German War, 1941 to 1943. So I think we kind of, well, we'd had a bunch of conversations ahead of time, and we kind of the opinion that it generally it's well researched and well argued book. But I suppose if we were to give a pithy comment, we'd say it probably misses the forest for the trees, and that. Yes, it's well argued, and yes, it does make pretty good use of the available material, but it perhaps d doesn't really make a point in the sort of broader context of the war considered. But that said, what is this book all about? So the subtitle kind of gives it away, but the two sort of questions that the author starts with and sort of aims to address in this book is are twofold. So firstly, it's the extent to which, and I'm kind of paraphrasing as well, so the extent to which Germany was able to provide reinforcements and replacements needed to maintain the strength of the German army, or at least the German army, German army in the Eastern Front, the Osthier. And secondly, to what extent these replacements were reflected in the fighting capabilities of the German army in the Eastern Front during the period considered, which is again 1941 to 43. And so before we get into it, maybe provide a little bit of context into or with which this sort of book was published. So this book is part of a more recent trend of World War II scholarship. So this is like past 10, 20 years or so, which is coming to sort of make the point, or sort of make more of the point, that the outcome of the war in the Eastern Front, especially, is as much due to the USSR improving in their sort of tactics and doctrine over time, as much as it is due to sort of German sort of failings in a manner of different ways. So the immediate sort of post-war literature was very much of the opinion that it was very much a lost victory for the Germans rather than a victory hard won by the Soviets. In fact, I think Heinz Guderian's memoirs is literally called Lost Victory, so I give that away a little bit. And so as this author kind of points out, a lot of the discussion with respect to sort of materiel discusses a lot of the discussion around the materiel tends to overemphasize losses, and in particular total losses, and does not really make a distinction between different categories of casualties. And this is a highly technical point that he goes into in quite a great level of detail that perhaps I don't always appreciate. And I think I might get to some of these other points a bit later. So yeah, so I mean, to be honest, I mean, I think I probably speak for Simon as well on this, but I'm not particularly overly sort of conscious of this sort of evolving sort of landscape of the scholarship, in that not historian by trade, and just picking up this book as one of my first entry points into this discussion. But I just talk about it in terms of the sort of quote unquote Glantz era. So Glantz being David Glantz, who's one of the sort of preeminent Western scholars on World War II, and especially the Eastern Front, who has made very effective use of only relatively recently available Russian Soviet resources. And that's kind of what's led to this sort of reassessment of the overall sort of landscape of the conflict. So I think maybe just get into the discussion a little bit now. So before getting to the real sort of meat of the argument, so he splits up the book into a bunch of different chapters, and sort of first, he talks a little bit about the interwar period and kind of leading up to, obviously, the Second World War. And so what's interesting is that it's often termed, or it's often discuss that, you know, the German army or sort of the Wehrmacht, as the sort of Nazis remodels the German army, was sort of lacking in the ability to scale up. So there was a very much a shortage of both reservists and officers. And I think I've heard quite a few times that a lot of people sort of attribute this to the restrictions laid down by the Versailles Treaty, which obviously restricted the total headcount of the German military quite substantially. And I think that's been quite well argued by various different writers on the subject. And I think often it's termed as like the sort of main success of the Versailles Treaty. But then something, and I think it probably sort of washed over me a little bit when we read it, but I think this must have come across in one of the early books we reviewed, The German Way of War, which was to say that this wasn't just in response to these restrictions, but also the sort of relatively new doctrine largely attributed to the first chief of the army, commander of the Reichswehr, Hans von Sect, who was very much of the opinion that the sort of modern military that he was sort of envisioning what would take place, envisioning as happening sort of in the near future, would be one that was primarily driven by a much smaller set of specialist military personnel. So like getting away from the masses of infantry that perhaps typified like earlier conflicts. And so this again led to this bias of wanting a much sort of smaller, more manageable armed forces rather than what eventually was required in the Eastern Front in World War II. And I thought that was quite an interesting point to make leading into this. So I think that's kind of all I have to say about this build-up period. I don't know, Simon, if you want to say anything. Yeah.
Really, I think you've covered it quite well. Yeah, it was, I mean, I have to say I really had not much kind of previous experience of reading books around the military kind of situation in the 1930s in Germany. So I came into this with very little background knowledge, and it was quite shocking at the rate at which the German army managed to kind of rebuild itself following the Versailles Treaty and kind of the German or the Nazi refusal of that treaty. Yeah, I mean, I think that we're on the basis of reading this book, we decided that we were going to also look at the kind of German economy. So in a future review, we'll be talking about the rearmament from that point of view. But it's just incredible that they managed to recruit so many people to the army and build up so many stockpiled weapons in preparation for what became the Second World War. I don't think I have anything else to add about the pre-war period.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Sort of moving on from that discussion a little bit, it also talks about how the German sort of rearmament occurred and sort of the early sort of early years of the war, which was sort of typified by highly successful and very sort of short, sharp campaigns, such as, you know, campaign in Poland, campaign in France and Low Countries, etc., which were sort of quite total victories for the Germans. And so in this period, Germany was still kind of struggling with a lot of the constraints that it had to deal with economically. So although there was some, to a certain extent, some sort of military buildup ever since, you know, the Versailles Treaty, to a certain extent, it really kind of stepped up once Hitler came to power in the set of the 2 4-year plans, the latter of which wasn't actually completed by the time that the war kicked off. But there were some real challenges that they had to deal with. So again, because of the small pool of reservists and because of Germany being a relatively sort of advanced industrial economy, there was a large set of men in like prime fighting age. So that's kind of like from 20s to like 40s, with protected employment status, which meant that they couldn't easily be replaced and taken and drafted into the military. And so that meant to say that going into the war, there was very little ability to actually expand their ranks of men in the fields without a detriment or long-term detriment to the economy. And again, that this wasn't the cause of any sort of major sort of shutdown of the economy, was more just down to the relatively short time and the relatively few casualties that were experienced during these sort of opening years of the war up until obviously 1941, which meant that Germany could ultimately sort of continue to expand its economy and whilst also achieving these fairly grand military goals. So then it's coming into the actual sort of real meat of the book, which is, you know, the entire sort of Eastern Front campaign up until like mid 1943, sort of kind of makes the point that throughout this period, Germany was mostly able to, well, more than mostly, pretty much entirely capable of replacing any losses that experience any of the personnel or material, and that the real failings that led to sort of, you know, primarily sort of operational failures were mostly down to logistics and intelligence. And that there's a bunch of different reasons sort of given as to why. So on the sort of intelligence side of things, this is not really something dealt with too much, but from what I understand, like German military intelligence was not really a strong point throughout the war. This often meant that people were sent to the wrong part of the front, because there wasn't the information to sort of make a more informed decision. And there's also the issue of logistics, in that that there wasn't really the, I suppose, infrastructure in place, the sort of system in place to really make sure that people got to where they needed to be in the right amount of time with the necessary resources that they required. And there's also kind of this element of the sort of, I suppose, a political ideological element, in that, you know, going into Operation Barbarossa especially, there was an expectation that this could be, or there was an expectation that this would be over in a relatively short space of time, meaning that what surpluses were available were not made available. And we see that sort of happen again and again, and it kind of leads to this characterization of responses by the high command and sort of the inner sort of political circle being somewhat sort of reactive rather than proactive. So this sort of is sort of two sort of key elements to that. So often resources are only made available following sort of a fairly significant reversal, and then also the stepping up of the sort of economic effort again is only sort of made in response to a major reverse rather than ahead of time. So do you want to add anything then?
Well, yeah, I just had a couple of questions that the book threw up for me, really. Firstly, I think it was mentioned in Enduring the Whirlwind, or I might be misremembering, and it was actually mentioned in The German Way of War, which we reviewed as our first book, but I feel certain that one of those two books mentioned the German high command in the army were quite negative about the idea of the campaign to begin with. They didn't really support it, and that's potentially also why there was, you know, there were issues from the outset in terms of the preparation, because it was a war that the army commanders didn't really want to embark on. But a kind of question I had when I read it, while I was reading this book, and I don't think, unless I missed something, I don't think it was really answered, was whether the campaign that was being planned, obviously the goal was to crush the Soviet Union quickly. Was there any thought given to what would happen if that didn't take place. Like, as actually transpired, the offensive kind of ground to a halt outside of Moscow, and it became a kind of positional war, a war of attrition that the German army then kind of proceeded to lose. But was there really any kind of like calculation made to, you know, try to win the war if it got to that point? I suppose that there was, because later on, around the middle of the book, Lickey kind of deals with the attack of Army Group South on the Caucasus region and the attempt to kind of capture the like oil producing areas of Russia to help maintain the war effort. So I guess that there was, but like you say, that felt more reactive than it did pre-planned or kind of pre-thought out. So yeah, I don't know if like one of my criticisms of this book was that the kind of, and I know that it's really impossible to say because there would be a lot of hindsight involved, and a lot of the German commanders who survived the war were trying to cover their own reputations. But how clear was the plan before they embarked upon it? I didn't feel that that was really answered.
Yeah, I think so. I have kind of similar concerns about this. So it's not really covered in this book so much, but reading around, especially David Starhill has covered this in quite a lot of detail, and there was quite a lot of war gaming and planning leading into Operation Barbarossa. But it was generally kind of the assumption that it could be a relatively sort of, you know, knockout blow to the Soviet Union. And I suppose what you might characterize the more sort of critical sort of elements within the military, especially, were somewhat silenced. And it feels like in the high command, especially, that the main concerns was not so much the proposition of a general invasion of the Soviet Union, but the sort of main thrust. So at the time that the head of the OKH, Franz Halder, was of the opinion that it needed to be directed much more so towards Moscow, whereas Hitler wanted to secure the more economically important regions of the north and the south. And he kind of, I mean, it's kind of awesome, but it's quite funny story. Well, funny, I suppose. It's kind of amusing in a sort of darkly comedic way, in that he was kind of at the same time as just going along with whatever Hitler sort of said, he was secretly planning to kind of force Hitler's hand a little bit by trying to make Army Group Center the most powerful line of attack of the Operation Barbarossa. But and from what I understand, in general, there wasn't really a plan B. And there was kind of a general sort of assumption that it would be a knockout blow within a relatively short space of time. So that there was this understanding that the invasion was much more a case of trying to knock out the Soviet forces on along the border. And then it was more of a sort of mop-up situation from there, because although they obviously did anticipate there being some element of reservists that the Soviet Union could draw on, they didn't anticipate the sheer numbers that they could actually draw up in a fairly short space of time. Yeah,
I think you made a really good point in your notes earlier that part of that might have been due to the fact that Russia was less developed economically and technologically, to a certain extent industrially less developed, and so potentially could draw on larger pools of reservists and resources, like human resources, to refill the ranks of those armies that were wiped out. But yeah, it just seems astonishing to me that the plan that the German army had was to win quickly. And when that became, when it became obvious that there wasn't really, that wasn't really achievable, they then didn't really do anything else. I mean, they tried to kind of like hold their position, and Licky talks quite in quite a lot of detail about how, you know, during the winter of 1941 to 42, there was a kind of real like crunch point where the army was under a huge amount of pressure, and the losses that it sustained couldn't be replaced easily enough or quickly enough because of the distances involved. But then during 1942, in the kind of spring, summer, those losses were kind of gradually replaced and equipment was repaired and things like that. But having recovered from that initial setback, there wasn't really another, there was a kind of renewed offensive in the south to try to capture the Caucasus. And there was this kind of idea that the north and the middle army groups, the center army groups around Moscow would kind of hold. But yeah, it just seems strange to me that there wasn't more of an emphasis on kind of, you know, movement and trying to lure Soviet armies into pockets or traps or things like that. You know, considering that that worked so well in the First World War, you know, on the Eastern Campaign with Tannenberg and all that kind of stuff, there was, yeah, it seemed strange. And I wondered if that was, maybe it was just a political thing that they couldn't admit that the war was going badly and a retreat would seem like defeat. So they had to hold ground rather than try to kind of reduce the lines to kind of more defensible position. I mean, that was something I'm aware that I'm jumping around quite a bit at the moment, but as a caveat, I would like to point out that I finished reading this book about 2 months ago, so it's not all that clear in my memory anymore. But Licke makes the point repeatedly and quite well, I thought. Like you say, it's a very like a staggeringly well-researched book. It's incredible the amount of detail that he managed to recover and relate in a book about the various strengths of the different army groups, formations, corps, all of that kind of stuff. But he seems to kind of approach the issue as like saying, well, the German army was physically able to replenish its losses for the first 2 to 3 years of the war with Russia, and therefore should have been able to maintain its fighting capabilities as if it was, you know, maintain the same capability rather as it did at the beginning of the war. But by 1942, the front line had stretched to kind of like 4 or 5 times larger than it actually, than it started at. So those, having the same number of soldiers as you did at the beginning of the war still wouldn't have been enough to make it, make that difference, I don't think. Although, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, that, I mean, kind of general point here, right? Because he does talk about that the German army was able to sort of replenish its forces basically at least twice over in this period considered for each of the sets of spring summer campaigns. But, you know, as you're saying, like, it's potentially not sufficient to just replenish the number given, because they both need both, you know, people on sort of within what is worth sort of on sort of defensive duty, but you know, behind the lines, as well as to sort of be able to reinforce the people in the field. And also, yeah, just something that came to mind is that the losses are not even so in the Eastern Front, especially that there was a significantly disproportionate number of officers that were lost, which were not easily replaced, and this meant that they required an accelerated drafting of First World War veterans. And there's also the element of, you know, qualitatively, that might not be the same fighting force, so let's, you know, drop out and, you know, NCOs and other people doing sort of paperwork behind the scenes. But I mean, perhaps before we get carrying on with this point, it might be worth just talking about like where these reinforcements were made, were drawn from. So basically, we said earlier that leading into World War II, you know, Germany didn't have a great pool of reservists it could draw on yet. For whatever reason, it was able to effectively replace a lot of these shortages, or at least on paper. And this seems to be down to, I think, two main reasons. So basically, he kind of makes the point, and this is like highly technical, and I honestly cannot recall a lot of the terminology, but he makes the point that basically, like, when you're talking about the German army, for instance, it's not like just one big mass of men. They actually come in like different, have different buckets that they're assigned to. And so essentially, when losses are assigned or casualties are assigned to, say, the actual fighting strength, that isn't to say that's there aren't potentially more men immediately available to draw on. They just sit in different buckets of or categories of troops, and this is essentially how they're able to replenish troops in a relatively short space of time, because they're there somewhere in the field, but not like actively fighting right then. And then the other side of it is also like being able to draw on other sort of sources of labor, so they could pull out the men of fighting age from these critical industry roles. So some of these gaps are filled by the use of imported goods and equipment, or captured equipment, more likely. Also, you know, making use of foreign or forced labor to fill these shortages. Obviously, it's like slave labor was one of the core marks of the Nazi war effort. And also, at least following the Battle of Stalingrad, especially, the sort of reorientation of the economy as a total war economy, which removed a lot of the protections that were previously in place for skilled laborers. And so these are the sort of basic means with which they were able to replace their losses in this period of time, from what I understand. But that there were sort of, on the flip side, there were kind of like competing elements as well. So he makes the point that just because men were made available for the military doesn't mean to say that they immediately went to the army. They were drawn into the other branches of the military, and fairly disproportionately to the Luftwaffe, for a number of different reasons. And this kind of has this like other sort of weird sort of, I suppose, a political element as well, where the Luftwaffe might be, you know, having the lion's share of, or sort of disproportionate share of these incoming recruits. But they were sort of still aware of the needs to make these available to the army in the Eastern Front. And so at one point, at least during the Fallblau campaign, that they made them available to the army, but insisted that they wear the Air Force uniform and only had access to like Air Force equipment available to them, which meant they were perhaps not as effective as they would have been if they were drafted into the army directly. And I don't know if there's any more to that.
No, well, that was quite a shocking moment of the book, I think, that this decision was made politically to kind of satisfy the Luftwaffe to retain those recruits as members of the Luftwaffe and to under-equip them deliberately as a result, but then send them to the front line. And I think, I don't have a note of it, but Lidke kind of mentions that they sustained horrible casualties as a result of being so badly prepared and badly supported in terms of equipment. And that decision was entirely political. It was just for the sake of maintaining the prestige of the Luftwaffe and kind of being able to report certain numbers of new Luftwaffe kind of soldiers and things like that. But there seems like that was from reading this book, it seemed like there was a lot of infighting, which I think you kind of mentioned earlier, within the various departments of the Nazi government around where manpower would be placed. And every decision that was made that tried to recruit replacements for the soldiers that were being killed on the Eastern Front had to be balanced against the need to keep factories working, replace losses in the Luftwaffe and kind of increase the size of the Luftwaffe, similarly the Navy as well. And also, Luke made a really good point that during this entire period, the invasion of Russia, the Nazis also had to continually occupy France and Holland and like large areas of Europe, and also fight the war on in North Africa as well. So there were other drains that even if the army were to get 100% of the recruits, there were other areas and theatres that they were also required to hold down.
Yeah, so basically you had this idea that as a whole during this period, the armed forces actually grew in terms of total strength, but that wasn't reflective of a general increase in fighting strength on the Eastern Front as well. Yeah, and so the other thing he talks about is how over this period of time, the sort of quality equipment generally improves. So like one noticeable element is that the sort of Germans that invades Soviet Union in 1941 has a sizable minority of tanks being fielded are the significantly outdated Panzer ones and twos. And over time, these are increasingly replaced by the much better equipped Panzer threes and fours. And so this is generally sort of taking the point that it's not just the number of tanks somewhat seems consistent or increased in certain places, but are qualitatively much better and a much better matches for the Soviet tanks at the same periods. Again, it's one of those things, not sure how convinced, because throughout this time, Germany consistently struggles to have a consistent, well, it is unable throughout the Second World War to actually be self-sufficient in oil, which obviously has implications for, you know, their operations, but also, you know, they would still be significantly outnumbered in terms of tanks from just the Soviets, but also from the Allies as a whole. So not so sure I'm into that. And it also doesn't really reflect the fact that the general quality equipment from the Allies is improving over this period of time as well. So not sure how significant that would be.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, and something that he doesn't address at all, really, that the kind of Allied equipment would have also improved at the same or similar kind of pace as the German. I think, like, Lickey does mention the difficulty of getting new equipment to the front line, because he's, you know, the end of each chapter, he kind of revisits the production aspect of the war and talks about how the Nazis were able to kind of maintain quite high levels of production throughout this period. And like you say, a lot of the equipment that was probably outdated, like the Panzer ones and twos, were replaced with more modern equipment. But then he makes the point that because of the rail network in Russia, it was very difficult to actually get these tanks to where they needed to be without them breaking down on the way. And although he does kind of mention that around the midpoint of the book. Don't think that there's a kind of it doesn't kind of marry up in the later chapters. There's still an assumption that like these tanks were improving in terms of the technology, the capabilities of the tanks. Therefore, they should have been able to outfight the Soviet tanks. But there doesn't seem to be a huge emphasis on, you know, material losses from breakages and breakdowns and things like that. Also, he talks a little bit about the kind of changing situation with the Luftwaffe and the air defense that was kind of crucial to maintaining aggressive campaign. That, like, while the Luftwaffe started the war in fairly good shape and took very high casualties in the opening months and struggled to replace those losses in terms of aircraft and trained pilots and things like that, which meant that they were less able to support the general, the infantry and the cavalry or tanks in the campaign. And it's not that something that, I mean, not knowing that much about the war to begin with, it struck me as an interesting thing, because, yeah, that's not something that I thought about previously. It was a well-made point in the book, I thought.
Oh, is it, sorry, that it was like a general attrition for the Luftwaffe?
Well, yeah, and also how crucial the Luftwaffe was for actually supporting the infantry and supporting a kind of forward momentum in the war.
Oh, sure. Yeah, okay. And so basically, I think maybe leading into sort of more the specific sort of criticisms of this book. So basically, the main problem is, well, so two main things, well, kind of related. So basically, he talks about how potentially, like, ignoring the logistics situation, that there was, in theory, sort of surpluses that could have gone into service. And not just that, but especially when it came to sort of the armored divisions, that most of the losses were not total, and that given some, you know, sufficient time, there could be an ability to refit and repair and, you know, return them to their original fighting strength or close enough. But, I mean, this is kind of one of the fundamental points it doesn't really pick up on, and it's something that David Starhill sort of makes a really good point about, is that their sort of, you know, the actual kind of operation that they want to achieve is premised on the ability to move very quickly and sort of extract sort of major extract sort of major sort of wins in a short space of time, which obviously this goes against the time that they would need to actually refit and repair. So this becomes kind of this trade-off that they can't really sort of what would be the words? It would become sort of untenable situation in the long term. And so I don't really think he gives that enough importance that he does. He just says, like, there's an ability to refit, but yeah, there's not enough time to actually perform those in a total sense. And so the closest he sort of kind of gets to this is basically when he sort of relates the failure of Operation Typhoon, which leads to the Battle of Moscow, as down to the fact that there isn't time available to actually refit and repair. And so I think that's a really important point. And also when he's talking in terms of, yes, Germany may have been able to have an ability to replace its losses, at least during this time period, you feel like that it's more of a longer term cumulative effect, which outside of this period, it kind of relatively quickly falls apart. And I think it obviously it's not covered in this book so much, but in what I remember of, say, Adam Tooze's Weapon Wages of Destruction, is that you actually see that, like, most measures of industrial output increase despite very intense Allied bombing throughout 1943, 1944. And it's only from this accumulation of damage to both the supply chains, as well as a complete reduction in or exhaustion of what reserves that they have, is that things quite quickly head dramatically downhill in 1945. But it's only really throughout 1945 that most of these economic measures sort of collapse. And I think the same could be said of this line of reasoning as well, because fair enough, they have the ability to replace themselves, but if they're not able to achieve the victory that they need in this time frame, then it's kind of academic whether or not they replace them or not. So those are my main two complaints. I also thought it was kind of funny because like reading this book and contrasting it with, so I haven't read all of David Stonehouse's book, but I've read the first two books he's written basically about the Eastern Front and how they basically are talking about the same things but drawing very different conclusions. And in particular, it's funny because like in the first battle of Kyiv, you know, Litke, you know, comes away with this as being this, it's, you know, a preeminent example of like operational success of the German army and how they're able to extract these major sort of military successes. And yet, you know, Stahel says, well, it's basically all they could do based on where the armies were at the time and the supply situation. And most of the success was just down to Soviet incompetence at this point. So yeah, that was important or interesting contrast to me, at least.
Yeah, I think right at the beginning of this episode, you kind of said, I think summed up what we both felt about it, was it was a bit of kind of an issue of missing the wood for the trees, where, you know, theoretically, the German army could replace its losses in men and equipment throughout the first 2 years of the war with Russia. But it seemed to miss so much actual kind of, so much to the realities of the situation that it would have meant that even though it was able to replace its losses, that didn't, shouldn't have, you know, wouldn't have allowed it to continue the campaign with the kind of energy that it began with. You know, like you were saying earlier, the loss of officers being particularly high, the loss of NCOs, the fact that, you know, people, the recruits that were raised were younger and younger, or not, you know, previously not fit for duty, or various other kind of measures that the Nazis used to kind of try to keep the flow of men to the front line steady, just completely ignores the fighting quality of those formations and how that would have been affected by losing their kind of most experienced officers and soldiers. And also, like, my only other real experience of reading about World War II military history was when we read The German Way of War. And that book emphasizes again and again the importance of morale in warfare and maintaining high morale, beating your opponent down, like overawing your opponent. And this book made virtually no mention of the morale factor in the German defeat, which I thought was quite surprising, because the kind of casualties that were being sustained by units was horrific and would have surely had a massive impact on the morale of the surviving soldiers. The loss of officers, the fact that I can't remember which general it was, but I think he was the commander of Army Group Center, had a nervous breakdown at some point in early 1942. So that should kind of suggest that all was not well, and simply replenishing losses wouldn't have been enough to change the situation. Yeah, I feel like maybe I would have got more out of this book if I understood more of the actual kind of the higher level factors of the war, diving into a very, very detailed account straight off, I felt that it just didn't make a lot of the arguments didn't make a lot of sense to me. In, you know, high school history, the first thing that we learned about the Second World War and the invasion of Russia, the Nazi invasion of Russia, was that they were defeated by the weather and by the logistical situation in the same way as a kind of, you know, had happened to Napoleon in 1812. And I didn't read anything. I mean, I obviously have missed things like nuances in this book, but from my reading of it, that was still the kind of key thing that prevented the Nazis from winning the war, was that the fact that their equipment was breaking down. They had massive, massive supply lines. They didn't have enough trains or transport vehicles to actually get supplies and weapons from where they were in their depots to where they were needed. And the massive distances that had to be defended meant that they couldn't actually, you know, achieve what they needed to. But yeah, am I just completely misinterpreting everything and making it far too simple? Or?
I mean, not right. Ideas. It's just don't count out General Winter. No. No. I think it's more the case of like if you were to explain the cause of something, right? It's just like, yeah, fair enough. Like from what you hear from a lot of these writers, is that yes, fair enough. Like the winter did play, you know, an element, but it wasn't like a decisive element because obviously both sides experienced the same winter. Whether or not they were able to handle it, and it's more that sort of complex of factors, right? Because yeah, that they all had the same winter, but to a certain extent, maybe the Soviets were better equipped for it. You know, why is that? Because the logistical situation meant that the Germans had to make much more sort of pragmatic choices between: do we send out winter clothing or do we send out food and equipment? Because they had insufficient logistical infrastructure to support any other effort. So I suppose it's more the case of like it wouldn't be the cause, but it may have been a factor in the overall sort of war effort. Yeah, and I suppose those are most of the things I have to say. I suppose the other thing is that what's kind of a bit cheeky is that the book ends just before the Battle of Kursk, which is obviously like one of the final like major offensives by the Germans on the Eastern Front, and it kind of puts an end to like that their ability to actually force the issue with these sort of very dramatic sort of offensive campaigns, and quite quickly leads to a reversal of fortune. So I suppose maybe that would go against his argument a little bit, but fair enough.
That's
I think
sorry, I still have questions, Tom. We can't finish now.
All right, what's the question?
One of the questions was exactly that you know, in the introduction, Licke talks about how historically, you know, in the first few decades after the war, the narrative grew up that the German army or the Nazi, the Wehrmacht, won the war but it was lost for them by incompetence at the top. And I mean, I didn't really read anything that refuted that argument in this book, I don't think. I mean, yes, okay, I think he makes the point that Hitler and the kind of senior politicians of the Nazi Party were previously the ones that were blamed the most for the loss in Russia, and that there was actually quite a lot of involvement in the kind of higher levels in the army. But that still, to me, that was kind of like the higher levels of the army, it's a distinction. The distinction is quite vague between them and the senior Nazi party members. And they made, these were where the mistakes were being made. It didn't make sense to me that he was arguing that there was a kind of breakdown of command when it seemed as though, from my reading of the book, most of the attacks, most of the offensives that the Germans carried out were successful, at least in some way. They kind of on the ground were winning or beating consistently Soviet units, Soviet army formations, but lost on the kind of logistical side of things and lost, you know, were unable to maintain the momentum that they initially started the war with. And the kind of infighting at the top, the miscommunication at the top, the kind of inability to kind of appreciate the situation on the ground was what led to the reverses, which was my understanding of the situation to begin with. So I kind of, yeah, was left a little bit confused at maybe the nuance that Leguay was aiming for with this.
I don't know if he was actually aiming to answer all those questions. I think he kind of was. I don't think he was specifically kind of trying to address the sort of faults at the high command level, or like the inner circle. But there is reason to sort of say that the immediate sort of post-war literature, which was generally put forward by you know, former German generals or like people sympathetic to the lines, was that, you know, their sort of general argument was that Hitler was to blame, or bears the brunt of the blame, whereas it seems like it's kind of failings all around. But I don't think, because it's kind of outside of this book, but I think David Starhel does a better job of saying that, you know, even at the operational level, the German army wasn't all that successful, at least in the Eastern campaign.
Then we get into the similar kind of conversation that we had at the end of the German Way of War book.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of like touched on the idea of like, was it a war that Germany could win to begin with? Because I don't know if I'm just misreading these books, but a lot of them, to my mind, seem to be kind of asking questions about like what could have been done that wasn't done that could have led to a different outcome. But it seemed, the more that I've read about it, it seems kind of more and more impossible that the Nazis could ever have won a war of the scale that they were embarking on. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I would say, because I think I'm of the same opinion as well, but the more that I learn about it, the less I believe that they could have had any other outcome. But I think a lot of the literature, especially nowadays, is trying to sort of grapple with why exactly it seemingly went from like knockout successes to extreme reversals of fortune, because that's not immediately clear. And also, I guess maybe understanding how it happened the way it happened, because that you know that there's nothing to say that, you know, one direction here or there. I suppose it's more just like why it led to this sort of general invasion and how it was able to occur. But I think the main focus is more just in the terms of how it was that within the space of like 6 months that they were able to sort of have these, you know, ridiculous advances into the Soviet Union, and yet they weren't able to extract any of their war aims.
Mm.
And that's my general sort of understanding of the the literature at the moment.
Okay. That makes more sense, I suppose. Who was it that wrote the German Way of War? I keep forgetting his name.
Robert Cetina.
Cetina, that's right. Yeah. I think I liked his approach to so the history of that, the kind of Nazi invasion of Soviet Union, where he kind of outlined his understanding of the historian was not necessarily to ask the what if questions, but to understand why decisions were made. So I suppose it falls into that kind of area. I mean, I thought it was a very interesting book. I was astounded by the level of detail. The amount of research that must have gone into a work like this is kind of incredible. And Licke does a really good job, I think, of distilling that information as well. So that, you know, he's got formation sizes and unit strengths for almost every formation in the German army, down to the kind of, I think it's like the brigade level, or at least the divisional level, from the beginning of 1941 until 1943. And yet he's kind of condensed all that information and made it legible and understandable in a book that's about kind of, well, just over 300 pages. So I think it's a really good piece of scholarship and quite an amazing achievement in terms of just the sheer scholarship that was involved. But I feel, like I said earlier, that I probably don't understand this subject enough to have got as much out of it as maybe I could have done had I known more context.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know. I don't think my opinion is much different. Perhaps it needs a much closer reading, but who knows? I would say also, like, we are quite kind of stressing the sort of level of detail that it goes into, but it's actually not a particularly dry read, or at least in my opinion. It's actually quite readable.
I disagree. I thought
really?
I'll say the structure of the book, each chapter begins, and the chapters are kind of make sense in terms of the decision of where to begin and end chapters. So it kind of, you know, looks at the pre-war situation, the early war and the invasion of France and other kind of European states, and then the early part of the Russian invasion, etc., etc. But the structure of the chapter starts with a kind of like broad synopsis of what the chapter is going to cover. A discussion of the kind of military and personnel areas of the war. But then it moves on to, which I thought were really interesting, really good. Then it moves on to the kind of bit at the back of each chapter, which I dreaded, which was the production numbers. I mean, I now know how many machine guns Germany produced in June 1941, and I don't think I ever really wanted to know that, but I know that for every month virtually of the war. And I just feel that reading those production chapters was like pulling teeth. It was very dry.
I mean, fair enough. Well, I thought it was quite good. I also liked, I mean, probably didn't get this, but like reading it on the Kindle, right? You say, oh, you estimated like however long you are in the chapter, but then of course half that chapter is just tables. So it's like, yeah, I'm making like epic progress through this book.
I read the analog version, so I didn't get that.
Right. Well, what's the pity, eh? So maybe just, I think we said quite a lot on this, really. Maybe just wrap up. So would you recommend this book to anyone?
I would recommend it academically if you have an academic interest in the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. during the Second World War, then yes, I think it's it feels to me like it could be a really valuable addition to the literature of that subject. I didn't get a huge amount from it, or at least I didn't feel like I came away with any deeper understanding other than that, you know, there were massive logistical problems and the casualties involved were just like, I don't feel like I kind of ended the book having had any opinions changed, which I don't know. I feel like that's maybe a point of a book like this. But so backhandedly, yes, I would recommend it, but only if you're very, very, very interested in the topic.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Like, this was not like a general history of probably something you would suggest to someone coming into it. But I think it's quite interesting, sort of, maybe not a counterpoint, because as I was saying, like, this whole sort of era of scholarship is what I'm most familiar with. So it's not really contradicting any sort of opinions or sort of ideas that I've heard elsewhere, but it's a nice addition to that general sort of picture of how the sort of more recent interpretation of the Eastern Front or the direction that's taking. So yeah, again, so like Simon says, would recommend it to someone a bit more familiar with the subject, but not to a newbie. So with that said, what are we reading next?
Well, next, I'm going to have to stand up and go to my bookshelf.
Oh no, well, don't want to inconvenience you too much.
So next up, we're reading The Deluge by Adam Tuzi. So we're actually going to start a Tuzi of both of his works on the kind of economy of the interwar period and the Nazi economy. And starting off with The Deluge, which covers the Great War and the remaking of the global order. So it kind of, focuses on that interwar period.
Yeah, so these reviews come in by the twos, as they say. How are you getting on with it?
I haven't started it yet.
What?
I've been reading a book about the Peninsula War.
But which peninsula?
The Spanish Peninsula.
All right, okay.
The Napoleonic Peninsula War. The book is called The Spanish Ulcer by David Gates, I believe. And I would recommend it. Lots of counter marching involved, which is quite baffling to me. But it's interesting. So when I finish that, I'll start The Deluge.
Okay, yeah. So I'm a little over halfway through, actually.
Oh no! Okay, I've got to carry on.
It's a lot different than I thought it was going to be. It's a really good follow up to the Vanquished. So it's much less about, or at least the first half is much less about the interwar period, but the sort of tail end of the First World War. And it's very well done. It's very rich sort of a take on that period of time. And lots of things that I hadn't come across before. Enjoying it, looking forward to it. Very different to what I thought. Also, as we may have hinted that, we're going to also be reading The Wages of Destruction, which I did read quite literally half a lifetime ago, but we'll need to reread again. Adam Tuzi is a really good writer. He's a very engaging speaker as well, if you've listened to any of his lectures, and he writes quite a lot. So he's done, I did start it was about basically the COVID lockdown period. Obviously it's not really history, but it's also done something about the Great Recession as well in 2008, 2009. Didn't read that. Probably want to read that at some point. Interested in that. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. I think, when one of the things that kind of led to us choosing Wages of Destruction and the Deluge next was reading about the production of German war materials in during the whirlwind. There's a lot of detail about how much was produced, but no real mention of how that was actually paid for, how the German economy kind of functioned. So yeah, it'd be really interesting to approach the history of the Second World War from that perspective.
Yeah, it'd be cool. Yeah, about that. I mean, that will be sometime later. Maybe this side of the new year. Who knows? Probably not. That's quite optimistic, maybe. All right. I think that's everything. So again, thanks for listening and catch you in the next one. Goodbye.